Good morning. The court's ready to hear argument. Are you ready to proceed? Mr. Romero?
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. This is an appeal from a trial in the Superior Court of this lady, Sharonda Good, that had a, I guess, a horrible experience, first in losing a child, and then in the viewing process of the body of the stillborn. That was 23 weeks, I believe, when it was stillborn. The appeal centers on two issues. One is the issue of whether the court below erred in not instructing the jury on outrageous conduct, which would have made the test for damages severe emotional distress, as compared to a negligent infliction of emotional distress, which requires a physical injury. Our contention is that there was sufficient evidence before the lower court that the court was required to allow this to go to the jury. Of course, it's pretty well obviously clear that the Superior Court does not decide whether the evidence is or is not true, or weigh the evidence or so forth. Its function is simply to decide, can a jury, is there sufficient evidence for a jury to decide that this was outrageous conduct?
Can you explain for me your take on the jury's answer to the interrogatory that your client's damages or injuries were not proximately caused by Bay Health? Is that because she had some other condition that caused these injuries, or was it because against the advice of a Bay Health employee, she peeked through the blind to see the child after being told you may not want to do that?
I'm not sure, incidentally, that she peeked against the advice, but we can put that aside as an issue of fact. But my belief is that, and I believe it's pretty clear, that the instruction which says that you have to have a physical injury, without explaining to the jury in some detail other than just a passing statement, that a physical injury does not mean something like a broken arm. In fact, Mr. Turner, in his summation to the jury, made a point of it that, you know, you need physical injury, and I think he says something like, the reason why we need is because we say to Mr. Satterfield, I think his comments to the jury were something like, Mr. Satterfield, what is your physical injury? If Mr. Satterfield was claiming that he was hurt by this. The physical injury part, I think, frankly, was a killer, so to speak, because the jury, when they go back, they try to use their common sense, try to use whatever they learned in life. And if you talk to them about a physical injury, there really was no physical injury here in the sense of the layman's view of a physical injury, like a broken arm. The court, I mean, Dr. K did say that, yes, you know, all these depression and all this problem she has, or I think the question was asked whether it was bodily injury, I think yes, but still, physical injury. And the judge made it clear that if all there is just emotional, that's not enough. Now, why it's important and crucial that the result...
Wait, before you get to that, I'm still confused about the question that Justice Ridgely just asked. Whether there was a physical injury or not is not a question of proximate cause, is it? It's a question of whether there was damage or harm.
Well, did this cause the damage that you can award, which would be a physical injury? Was there a physical injury caused by this conduct, negligent infliction of emotional distress conduct? And my belief is that they simply said nothing wasn't caused. Nothing was caused by, I mean, what we're supposed to find was caused was not caused by this conduct of the hospital. That's what I believe occurred. Obviously, I have no way of knowing because the jury was never asked. But it is important, though, I think, and crucial that to realize that if the jury had been told under the pattern instruction 14.1, which is the accepted law, that if you had outrageous conduct, and it says, if you find that defendant's conduct was outrageous and extreme and that this conduct caused the plaintiff to suffer severe emotional distress, then you must find defendant liable for damages.
And what was the evidence of outrageous conduct that you think warranted an instruction?
That's the key of this whole appeal, of course. Three things that are listed in the brief and that I believe support this, and that is, first, the hospital said that there was an unidentified baby and an unclaimed baby, a baby that was not claimed, which was outrageous because obviously they should have had a baby that was identified, and this lady did not. It isn't that she didn't claim this baby. She was waiting for this autopsy report.
The problem I'm having is this. Anytime something is not handled properly, you could say, that's outrageous. You know, how could they have done this wrong? How could they have done that wrong? But for as a matter of law, outrageous conduct is not simply doing something wrong, is it?
No, of course not. But there is, though, however, more. And the last part of this is that they had a policy for viewing these bodies of loved ones. And the policy was not only not completely ignored and not even thought about, not even considered, not even applied in any way whatsoever, but worst, the security guard that basically handled this first said the policy didn't apply to her because she's a security guard. Then she admitted that it did apply to her. Then she said she didn't know what the policy was. Then at trial she said, yes, she had been trained the policy, knew what it was, but chose not to follow it. Now, in a sensitive situation, like viewing a dead child, which is probably the most grievous of all things that a human being has to encounter in life, It is callous. It is outrageous for someone that knows that they're supposed to do it a certain way and says, but I'm not going to do it. I mean, I can't think of anything, frankly, more callous.
So you're saying that there's testimony in the record that this security person intentionally violated the hospital policy with respect to viewing a dead child and did it out of some malice or ill will or something?
No, I'm not saying she did out of malice or ill will.
But the testimony is that this person intentionally violated the policy because this person just didn't want to be bothered with the policy.
Well, maybe consciously, I guess maybe a better word, or I guess intentionally the same thing. She testified that, yes, she had been trained by the policy. She knew about the policy, but she did not follow it that day.
And was there any explanation given for why it wasn't followed that day?
She did give some explanation as to why she didn't follow it. I think she said she didn't have time to follow it, maybe, or she didn't know that they were coming. Some words that affect.
Well, isn't that kind of your standard somebody on the staff messed up situation as opposed to outrageous conduct?
Well, yeah, somebody in the staff did mess up because they all messed up all the way down the line because they should have picked it up the very first time that she came there and said, I'm supposed to identify my baby. And then I think it was Mrs. Wiley was the first one she talked to, should have said, okay, we have a policy, and they called. There's a whole slew of things they do. She didn't do it. Another person didn't do it, and then the last person that opened the door and let them in was this Donna Winchester, which was security guard. She didn't do it either, but she had the last opportunity and the obligation to do it because she was supposed to show the baby without going through all these these things, these preparations and so forth, which she didn't, she said she knew about, but did not follow it. So it's not just a mistake in the sense that, oh, gee, they made a mistake. It's that she knew it was a mistake. She knew it was wrong to do it, but did not follow the policy that was established something like 20 years, 30 years ago. I forgot.
You mentioned you were going to identify three acts or series of events that were outrageous. The first was losing track of the body, the lack of identification.
Right.
And the second was not following the protocol. And what was the third?
Well, the first and third are similar. One was unclaimed baby. They not only had a baby that they said was identified, but they also had a baby that they said was unclaimed. And I think it's outrageous when you have a baby and you say to the mother, your baby's unclaimed. Your baby's not identified. You have to come and claim and identify him. I mean, it starts you off with this thing that, what they do with my baby, you know, just a sack of bones, so to speak. And those are the three things. But the baby, of course, had been there for 16 days at an autopsy, and obviously was not in a condition to be viewed by the mother without at least some preparation, the things that one would do to view it. In fact, she got scared and decided not to view it, and then went outside, and then, of course, saw through the window. I'm not sure whether the facts are that she was told not to look and looked, as Justice indicated, or she just basically looked. I'm not clear on that fact.
Well, I got that from Mr. Turner's brief.
I don't know if you could. Well, Mr. Turner's a very clever attorney.
But the record reflects that she peeked through the blind.
Yes, it does.
Whether she was told initially not to do it or
that she
simply
the blind.
Said, I don't think I can do this, and then she was going to wait in the hall and then, for whatever reason, changed her mind and peeked through the blind.
Yeah, I mean, when you say peek, it's like someone, you know, it's not like this and peeking. I mean, the blind was there, she was there, and when it came out, she saw it. She could have turned her head, I suppose, but she did not. So, but the issue still remains, was that sufficient, those three things, and this conscious violation of the policy in this very sensitive situation, and the courts do treat this an exceptional circumstance, a very sensitive situation, and are more, whatever the word is, more liberal, I guess is the word, in that situation, could the court or could a jury find that there was outrageous conduct? The function was for the jury to find, not for the judge, lower court judge to say, they could not find that, because I think reasonable minds may differ. And in fact, he said, and when he allowed the negligent infliction, he said, there's a lot of dispute here about this. Well, there's a lot of dispute about either negligent or outrageous. I mean, it's basically the same situation. So our position is that he erred in not letting the jury make this decision. And if he had done that, I believe the verdict would have been completely different, because that would have eliminated physical injury, which I think was the thing that the jury could not accept, because they just could not see, quote, physical injury. So that's all I have to say, unless you have any. I'm reserving some time, of course.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Turner.
Good morning. May it please the court. To answer Justice Ridgely's question, the jury heard evidence that the plaintiff in this case did not report any emotional distress about this incident until April 30, 2003, almost exactly 2 years after the event and 1 day before this lawsuit was filed. And while that's certainly not conclusive evidence that this was a fabricated claim, it was certainly something in the case, and I would submit that's what the jury decided when they answered the interrogatory as they did. I'd like to restate what...
Well, then how does that, assuming it was error to not give the instruction on intentional or reckless infliction of emotional distress, does that make that error harmless because of the ruling on proximate cause?
It would make it harmless because of the jury finding on the lack of existence of a connection between what was being complained about and the first evidence of alleged emotional distress 2 years later. Contrary to what's been argued in the brief and what Mr. Romuno has attempted to articulate this morning, the plaintiff at trial presented one theory of negligence against Bay Health, and that was that the hospital employees who were involved should not have permitted Ms. Good to see her baby. The expert who was retained in his deposition had articulated a criticism that the hospital was negligent in failing to identify the baby, but when he had not been shown the autopsy report, which the plaintiff, in fact, was shown before this incident, which clearly identifies the baby by name, Denise Good. And the evidence is uncontradicted in the case that the baby was identified at the time of autopsy, and it was identified at the time of the viewing that is the subject of this case by name tags that were placed on the body by the nurse who cared for that. So there's simply no claim and no evidence that this baby was unidentified. Ms. Good claims she was told.
Let me interrupt for a second. Why was she even there if there was no issue about identification?
She claims she was told that it was unidentified and was told by the funeral director that she had to go to the hospital and identify. And
generally, what we say is when people give sworn testimony, it's up to the trier of fact to either accept or deny their credibility. In fact, in criminal cases, we've had the defendant testify about things that the state contended were physically impossible, totally inconsistent with the testimony, and therefore there shouldn't be a lesser included offense instruction. And we've held that if that's the defendant's sworn testimony, the trier of fact assesses credibility.
I'm not arguing that point, Your Honor. What I'm saying is that she claims she was told she had to go to the hospital by a third party, not by the hospital, and that she had to do this identification procedure. The funeral director flatly denied that. But there's absolutely no evidence that any employee of the defendant required the plaintiff to do this. From the defendant's perspective, they were presented with a distraught mother who appears at the hospital demanding to see her baby that she had refused to see while she was a patient before it was buried. And if they had, and the charge of negligence was they shouldn't have let her. And they did let her, and that was the supposed negligence.
Well, help me understand the facts that the jury could consider and how this works on a continuum. If we have undisputed conduct or disputed conduct, at some point in time, a trier of fact has to decide whether it's negligence, it's recklessness, or it's outrageous. And what the trial judge did in ruling in your favor is said that, in his view, the evidence presented showed that the employees were either inartful, inexpert, using his word, untrained, or not thoughtful. Now, if the jury believed any of those things, they wouldn't have found negligence, would they?
Oh, I think so.
So you can, if you're not thoughtful, you're negligent.
You can be, certainly. I mean, negligence is carelessness. And I think it's clear that the jury found negligence based on the failure to follow the policy, which the plaintiff's expert used as a foundation for his claim that the viewing should have been refused.
So why did the judge correctly conclude that as a matter of law, no reasonable juror could have looked at this and found that it was outrageous, even though they found it was negligent? Why was this taken away from the jury as a matter of law?
Because the only evidence that was presented was that the two hospital employees involved knew nothing about the condition of this baby. They were presented with a request to view the baby by the mother, and the hospital has a policy that mothers of stillborns are encouraged to view their babies. So they're presented with a demand by the mother to view her baby. They don't know that the baby, how long the baby's been in the morgue. The baby's been in the morgue for the length of time it has because the mother hadn't yet made the arrangements for the funeral home to pick it up. They don't know that the baby's had an autopsy. She does. She doesn't tell them that. The secretary, who's not familiar with the nursing policy that is normally implemented while a patient is in the hospital, takes the plaintiff down to the morgue. They initiate a phone call to the security guard, who knows nothing about the plaintiff. The security guard, who likewise does not know about this policy, opens the door and allows the plaintiff's friend to see the baby. The plaintiff then chooses, having initially decided not to view the baby, and certainly wasn't pressured by the hospital to do so, she then bends down after being told by the secretary that you might not want to do that, and claims to have seen something. It's dubious whether she actually did see anything because of the contortion that would have been required. But those facts, when you contrast it to the operative language, if one assumes that Restatement 46 is applicable to a claim of this case, and the trial judge made that assumption without so deciding. But when you read the comment, the language of it about outrageous in character, extreme in degree, beyond all possible bounds of decency, atrocious, utterly intolerable in a civilized society, ending with, quote, outrageous exclamation mark.
Well, isn't that in the section that this court cited with approval in Pinder?
It did. And Justice Ridgely said when he was on the Superior Court that Cummings overruled McKnight. I'm not so sure. Well, it didn't explicitly overrule McKnight. It certainly overruled McKnight to the extent that Cummings raised an issue involving an attorney-client special relationship, and Section 46 talks about special relationships and different standards that are applied in there. I'm not aware of any decision by this court that has blanketly overruled McKnight and the elements of proof that are required under McKnight. But the fact of the matter is that the trial court didn't address that. It addressed plaintiff's claim that Section 46 applies to a claim of this sort and found that there were simply no facts that would support, that would allow a rational juror to conclude that the behavior that was at issue comported with the terminology that I've just read.
Well, is it your position that, let me just, as I understand your opponent's argument, this know-nothing aspect of the employees can never be outrageous?
Well, you never say never in a courtroom or in a hospital, but certainly not in this case, where the employees were doing nothing more than trying to accommodate a demand that had been made by the plaintiff. I mean, if they had gone out to the plaintiff and said, we insist that you come in here and do this, and they ignore a hospital policy in doing that, that might be a different case. But that's not this case. This is simply a case of two hospital employees attempting to accommodate a mother's request to see her child, and with nothing more to suggest that there's no evidence of ill motive. There's no evidence of any knowledge on these two employees about the condition of the baby. There's no evidence that the mother told them what she knew about the condition of the baby.
Well, but there is testimony that at least Winchester said she was aware of the protocol and decided to disregard it.
Well, that's what Mr. Ramuno said. I disagree with that. What she said was that when she was shown the protocol at her deposition, she claimed it wasn't applicable to her as a security guard, and that when she looked at it at the trial, she acknowledged that it was, but she acknowledged that she wasn't familiar with it. And so there's no evidence, and I would challenge Mr. Ramuno to point the court to any place in the transcript where he says this evidence exists, that this security guard made a conscious decision to disregard this policy, because the fact was she wasn't familiar with it.
As I understand Mr. Ramuno's argument, he's saying that if you have this elaborate policy in place that demonstrates a sensitivity to relatives or loved ones or friends that are viewing dead people, especially after an autopsy has been performed, then you shouldn't be conducting a hospital where people make decisions to let people into the morgue that don't know about the policy.
Well, you can make that argument, but it's hard to square that with the terminology of Section 46 about what constitutes extreme and outrageous behavior. It is people.
How can you? Well, we're getting back to my earlier question. How do we say that as a matter of law? What Mr. Ramuno says is you have a very elaborate policy in place that demonstrates a sensitivity to loved ones viewing people in the morgue, especially after an autopsy has been performed. And yet, you conduct your hospital in a way that people on your security staff and your secretarial staff take people into the morgue and don't even know about the policy. And he says he should be able to argue that's outrageous.
Well, and I say he needs to present some evidence that there was something about the conduct of these employees that rose to the level that is defined as being outrageous, and there simply wasn't any. There was no knowledge, there was no intention, there was no maliciousness. All there was an attempt to accommodate a very unusual request, because this policy is geared towards the normal situation, which is a patient's in the hospital, somebody dies, the nursing staff interacts with the patient and makes the arrangements for the viewing. Instead, this patient came back 2 weeks later, and it was an unfortunate situation, but it's very doubtful that it caused her any harm, and the jury so found. And to conclude that the acts of these two non-nursing employees somehow rose to the level of atrocious conduct is the trial judge who heard all this. And I would submit that...
Did I read the record correctly that the plaintiff was 20 years old?
Yes.
And that this was perhaps the seventh episode in which she didn't successfully deliver a live baby?
It was at least the eighth.
I mean, before she was 20 years old.
Well, this was either the 8th or the 9th, and she was 20 years old.
Was there any testimony in the record that gave any insight into the interaction she had with the stillborn, the prior stillborn children or any of the abortions?
Well, she claimed she buried one. Several of them were cremated and several of them, and I don't have the details of all of them, but several of them were aborted, and so that we weren't in with a far advanced fetus such as this. But there were all sorts of issues at the trial about, how could this second or two of supposed visualization cause all this harm to a person who had been inflicted with more tragedy in her life than most people would expect in 80 years as opposed to the 20 years that she'd lived. And she'd had tragedies subsequent to this, which also impacted her situation, with another stillborn following this one and then a live birth.
So that evidence was also before the jury and may have contributed to their conclusion that while she might have distress, it wasn't proximately caused by this episode.
Well, there was overwhelming evidence that she had multiple reasons to be distressed in her life, and that the things that had happened to her would distress most people. As I indicated at the beginning, I think the jury was persuaded by the fact that no mention of emotional distress related to this incident was made until the day before the lawsuit was filed, led them to make the finding that they found.
Can I ask another fact question? Was there evidence about the reaction and the level of reaction of the friend who saw the dead child?
There was no reaction. At the time, when she came into court, she had a reaction. Mm-hmm. 5.5 years later, and the plaintiff reacted probably 10 times during this trial and had to be let out of the courtroom.
Not the plaintiff, the other person.
No, the other person had no reaction at the time she saw the child, according to the testimony. When she came into court, she broke down and became hysterical. But that was 5.5 years after the fact, and the jury could weigh that for what it was.
Thank you.
Unless there are further questions.
Thank you.
In response to Mr. Turner's indication about that the hospital was not involved with this, with her coming there, that is not exactly correct, because she testified that when she called to inquire about her baby, Mrs. Wiley told her that her baby was unidentified and unclaimed. And she said she wanted to bury it, and she was told to contact the person, the funeral director. The funeral director, Mr. Torbett, told her, according to her testimony, that he could not pick up the baby until the baby had been identified and claimed, and she had to go there and therefore identify and claim the baby. So she went to Mrs. Wiley, who she had talked to earlier, and said, I think all this happened, I think, the same day, and said, I'm here to identify and claim my baby so I can have it buried. So she said, fine, she didn't know what to do. She called her boss called somebody else took her there, and then Mrs. Winchester, of course, was the one that opened the door. Now, so far as Mrs. Winchester was concerned, in her testimony, she did say that it refreshed her memory and that she had been trained in this policy. She says, so the question was, so that someone else, you know, you've been trained in this, and she said, yes, that she had been.
And what's the record cite for that?
Well, at page 205 of her testimony, there's a question.
Where is that in the appendix?
It's in page 180A.
A180?
Yes, A180A. And then if you go, he has an A at the end, but it's 180A, A, or A180. And then if you go to the next page, she said that she was asked, why didn't you follow the training in this case? She said, I didn't have a chance, and she said she wasn't given a chance. But then she was asked about the fact that the morgue door was locked and she had to open it. And the question was, the fact that she wanted to see her trial, that means that you could throw your training out the window? No, but you did know. Then tell me how you told her to wait while you went in to take care of the things you were supposed to take care of, that is, under this policy. And her answer was, on the day of this incident, I did not go by the policy. No, I did not. And so, I mean, there's other testimony, but she...
So is there a specific statement that she knew about the policy on that day?
She said, just what I read to you, that yes, that she did know about it,
she didn't get a chance to do it.
That was her excuse, but the chance would have been, but she has the key to open the door. She opens the door, goes in there first, prepares the baby, or calls all the people she has to call. She didn't do that. She just opened the door, period. And she said, I did not go by the policy on that day. So, I mean, there are cases that are cited in the brief, like those, the cases of Boyle, I believe, and Nagel, and other cases, Charlo, that deal with wrong plots, wrong coffin debts, and so forth, that frankly are not much different than this, and the court found that a jury could find that it was outrageous conduct. Let alone, of course, Cummins, which just involved an attorney, of course. But
are you going to respond to Mr. Turner's contention that the late reporting was a basis of the jury's conclusion that there was no proximate cause and that therefore renders harmless this error that you're saying was made?
Yes, the facts were in dispute. There are some facts that very shortly, within a couple of days, she went to see a doctor and was treated. There is some, she testified that way. I believe that the doctor's record didn't reflect it, but she testified she went there. It's also testimony that she was treated by some social worker. What he's really talking about is Dr. K in his record. She didn't go to see Dr. K for about 2 years. But she had been treated by other people prior to that, and she testified that she had gone to, I forgot the doctor's name, within days of this occurring, although, as I said, the record was not there, but that was her testimony. So it is true that this question about depression, Dr. K talks about, was 2 years after, but it is not true that she had no treatment whatsoever prior to that.
With the same facts that you used to establish negligence also establish the outrageous conduct?
Yes, I believe so. I mean, because...
All right, then if the jury is asked this question and answers as it does, do you find the defendant's negligence was the proximate cause of injury to Sharonda Good? No, Your Honor. Why isn't that Let's just make that substitution. Do you find the defendant's outrageous conduct was the proximate cause of injury to Sharonda Good?
Well,
no, Your Honor. Why doesn't that end the case?
Because if outrageous conduct had been part of the charge would not have been, do you find that this negligent conduct, whatever, was the cause of the injury? The charge would have been, do you find that the outrageous conduct caused severe emotional distress? See, that's my point. The whole thing was focused on injury because you need injury for negligence. You don't need it for outrageous. So if they had been asked the question, do you find that the outrageous conduct caused severe emotional distress, that's completely different than injury when we're talking about, quote, a physical injury. Again, I think the jury said, what physical injury are we talking about? You know, she didn't break her arm, you know, she didn't have a heart attack, blah, blah. But emotional distress, completely different.
And but the jury was instructed on pain and suffering and impairment, and all of those were injuries, were they not?
No, they really were not. They were instructed that as it was an element of damages, of course, those things, but they could not find in their favor unless they found a physical injury. Emotional alone was not enough. And I can read the charge, if Your Honor wants, because I
have it. Thank you. Right.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both. The court will take this matter. Excuse me?
Can I ask you a question?
Sure. Well, it's not the way it works, but I'm happy to let it work that way this morning.
Mm-hmm. Well, I wanted to ask. There's been a lot of discussion about whether the security guard knew about this policy and was trained in it. Mr. Munoz made one representation, and I've made another. And my position is the transcript's completely clear on that, but it's that part of this wasn't argued in the brief, so I didn't include that in my appendix. I don't know whether the pages in question, and really page 203 of Volume B, is where the testimony appears. I'm simply asking if the court feels that's a significant issue, could I submit the pages of the transcript or direct the court to the pages of the plaintiff's appendix if they, in fact, are in there?
Sure. Why don't you do that within a week? And then, Mr. Romuno, when you see those pages that Mr. Turner submits, you can reply in a week or comment on them. But and to the extent that Mr. Turner has any argument or editorial comment that accompanies the pages, you can respond. Okay?
Thank you.
Thank you.